Now stay tuned for To Your Health on WPVC LP Charlottesville, the show where food is on the table and center stage. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Now here's your host, MC Blair.
Good morning. Good morning. Yes, we are here. We're here live. To Your Health. Welcome. We have Jamie Barrett of Bel Air Farm today. Pretty awesome. Hey, Jamie.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, yeah. Awesome. So, you know, I wanted to say a couple of things first before we get started. They say you want to be healthier, well, and contribute to lower pollution and stimulate the local economy. Well, eating locally grown food can help you do all those. And a community gardens program, we've always stressed community-based agriculture here at To Your Health. And I saw a wonderful word because we are working closely with UVA as well. And the word is communiversity. So, of course, they have the Morven Gardens over the, off the old Kluge Estate. Yep. And so these people have started a communiversity gardens program.
That's great.
Yeah, it is. It is. They explore the flaws that make our current food delivery and transportation system so wasteful. They examine the political reasons why people in the U.S. are able to get enough calories to become obese, but have difficulty getting enough nutrition to be healthy. That's a problem, you know. But buying locally grown food doesn't instantly solve these problems, as we know. But doesn't mean you shouldn't bother, folks. It decreases the impact on the environment. It keeps our money in our community. And it increases our connection to local farmers, thus bringing them into the community as well. And they're likely to care about our health than some faraway conglomerate.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, they say, and it takes a commitment of all the community members to eating locally grown food, which automatically increases that entirely in community's access to fresh produce. And that's an important first step to boosting food security. And the Food Justice Network, who's a lot of great partners there, the local food hub and environmental negotiation and all that. There's many, the PBJ Fund, the City Schoolyard Gardens, the Urban Agricultural Collective of Charlottesville, of Todd Niemeyer.
All doing such great work, yeah.
They really do, you know, and they're getting the community involved, and that's what it's about. They said that the standard model right now for addressing hunger is emergency relief. And it's like, well, you know, local food movements present a different and more self-sustaining option.
Right, yeah.
Where you just won't have the hunger to begin with, you know? So, and it says they draw people from all across the community who care about the environment, health, nutrition, education, and economical development. That's so important. We need to take control of what we're eating and where it's coming from. And there's one county out there. It's actually in Illinois, DeKalb County, and they have donated nearly 10 tons of food to local pantries, daycare centers, schools, and senior citizen centers.
That's great.
Which, I mean, how can you go, you know, you can't get any better than that. Well, I want to ask you, Jamie, this is Jamie Barrett of Bel Air Farm.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Oh, man, our pleasure, for real. And, oh, by the way, I was just there and bought two beautiful chickens from them.
Thank you.
And Michelle McKenzie is down there. And you'll either see Jamie or Michelle or both on every Saturday.
Yeah, so. And Nat will be there, too, one of our crew members. We got a great crew at Bel Air. Come and check it out.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You do have to, folks. It's really good. How did you get started? Kind of a, you know, what did the farm look like?
Yeah. So there's kind of two different strands to the story. Bel Air Farm's been around for a long time, 1790s.
Wow.
Yeah, old farm, lots of agricultural history, lots of kind of agricultural lives in that span. It's recent history, Cynthia Davis is the owner. She's owned the farm for 40 years and raised a beautiful family there. And kind of in the last 10 years, she was starting to think about the long-term future of the farm, how to sustain it into the future, and also about how it was being productive. She had been leasing land to a corn and soy farmer in the area, Kevin Ingalls, who's a great farmer. But Sydney had wanted to see it become productive more in line with her ideas of organic food and sustainable agriculture. She's been a real good community member in Charlottesville for a long time, mm-hmm. and she wanted to open the farm up to the community in a way. So she started to kind of research how she could do that, and she wanted to start that business. In the meantime, I was up in New England in the Boston area, learned to farm up there, was farming for 8 years for a conservation group, and started my own small family, looking for an opportunity where I could be involved in a business, and found Cindy, who was looking for someone to start a business. So it was a real good kind of meeting. We talked for about a year. And then I moved my family down here onto Bel Air Farm. And me and Cindy and now our crew and Michelle McKenzie have developed, this is our seventh year of our CSA program.
That is great. So what did the farm look like when you first got there?
So it's 1,000 acres. It's a huge tract of land, mm-hmm. Wooded, wetlands, beautiful. Right, the Hardware River abuts the land on the one end, and so there's lots of historic floodplains there. And it was being hayed, some of the land, and it was being cultivated for soy and corn. And so we started right away. We moved in October and planted some garlic and mulched it, and then we kind of started developing the plan of how we were going to diversify this farm, how we were going to build up the soils and get this into a more sustainable ecosystem. And you know, 6 years later, 7 years later, we have a couple other businesses that we lease land to, 20 Paces Goat and Sheep Dairy, mm-hmm. And Stephen James Grass-Fed Beef Operation. And with these partners, we can we move around the land. We grow vegetables we manage about 100 acres. Any given year, we're growing on about 40. The other acreage is resting in cover crop. And we're moving the goats and sheep and the cattle into those areas to graze and deposit manure and build up those soil health. So it's been real exciting and a fun transition period to really see it all come alive under Ms. Davis's support and mm-hmm. And the hard work of the crew. And it's been a lot of fun. And the Charlottesville community is just such a supportive community for this type of thing. And we're really hungry for this, so
yeah.
We've been listening to what the community would like the farm to be, and so it's about like the possibility and about the energy that the community brings, and that's the exciting part.
The possibilities. That's a great word. And so I know you said it was mainly corn and soy, so I guess the soil was somewhat depleted with the monocultures going there. Or?
So it was a little depleted. The mm-hmm. organic mm-hmm. matter was down to about 1%, lower than 1%.
Yeah.
And so we've had to develop a short and long term fertility kind of plan for the farm. We bring in minerals to help us get our fertility levels where we need to be to produce, but in the long term, the cover crops and the animal rotations are the way we're going.
They were doing that in Europe, you know, centuries and centuries ago.
Yeah,
they knew. It must have been intrinsic. They must have just known that was, you know what I mean? Because there were certainly no publications out there.
Yeah, but also like, diversified farms were the way, you know, families lived because,
right.
you know, it wasn't also segmented. It was you know, a farmer had the cows and the chickens and grew the vegetables, and all those things kind of worked together. And so over time, that developed into a really good system. And then, you know, our system kind of broke it up. And
well, westernized diet, you know, the Western diet. My 2-minute drill today is going to talk about that and why that's something that needs to be changed, and why people like yourself and the other farmers and the community gardens and the university are working hard to change that perception, you know, of, well, I can just run right out and go to this place and buy a readily prepared meal, and that's going to be nourishment. You know, well, it's calories.
Yeah,
that's for
sure.
So you have 3 daughters out there, right?
Oh, yeah. Yep. I got Maggie, Franny, and Nora. Uh-huh. 10, 7, and almost 3. Yeah.
And your wife?
My wife, Callie.
Callie.
Yep.
Okay. And so I know they're helping, right?
Well, they do a little help. Callie works at Scottsville Library.
Oh, okay.
And it also does a little freelance editing. So her life, she's not a farmer by trade, but of course she gets sucked into it a little bit. And then
of course
the girls come down and help me out a little bit too.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. So when they're out there helping you, that really brings the family together, doesn't it?
It does. And you know, farming is kind of a lifestyle, and so it's nice when it can be. The family is involved because it needs to be.
So let me ask you this. Do you notice that, well, I'll back up a minute. I have heard throughout my life, parents, and I was a parent, I guess I still am in that case, but talking about how their children didn't open up to them about, you know, problems that they had or what was going on. And I know as a child, I would keep a lot of stuff secret from my mom and dad. Oh, my goodness, I didn't want to tell them that, you know. And then I've heard from folks that participate in not only the community gardens, but, you know, also other farmers talk about when they're in the field and they're working, the kids seem to maybe open up a little more.
That's interesting. I can... You know, my girls are a little young. They're not out there with me, you know, but it sort of makes sense to me. We have a lot of, the crew and I have a lot of great conversations in the field all the time. And it's just the work is just so basic, you know, and not in a kind of judgmental way, but in a very, you know, this is the food we eat. This is the land we live on. All these things are ingrained in us on a really basic level, you know. So when you're doing that type of work, I feel like a lot of veils drop and you just present yourself, you know, and it's easier.
Yeah, I can see that. I really can. So tell me about the city market, how is that experience for you, you know, interacting with the consumers and telling
your
story probably 10 times a day.
And yeah. Well, it's wonderful because I got into farming and it kind of made my life complete. You know, I was floundering around, didn't know what I was going to do with myself, and found this place called the Farm School and discovered farming, that I loved the work, that I was really needing that connection to the seasons and the land that I didn't have before.
That was up in the New England area?
That was up in New England
area.
Right,
okay.
And So I see one of our goals at this farm as being a place where people can discover that. And so when we interface with the public, that's like what it's all about. We're trying to present that connection and however far people want to take it. You know, some folks want to come out to the farm and volunteer, and some folks want to bring their kids out and do pick your own. Some folks just want to go to the market and see and know that their lettuce was grown sustainably and take a lot of peace from that. But we want to present them with options and let them discover and explore. And so that's, the market's a great place to kind of start that process.
So you actually have people volunteering.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Do they work for food or? Is
well, that we always send volunteers home with food for sure.
Okay.
And actually, Michelle, who helps manage the farm, is starting up a volunteership on the farm. So every I'm going to say Tuesday, and you should check our website. If folks come in at 9, mm-hmm. they'll get a half hour long presentation about some aspect of the farm, whether it's soil health. Or livestock management, and then for 2 hours we'll take that group and get them involved in some sort of work on the farm, and then everyone would go home with some produce too.
Oh, that is great.
Yeah,
and we're talking with Jamie Barrett of Bel Air Farm, and where is that?
We're just south of town, halfway to Scottsville, off of 20.
Just off of 20.
Yeah, off on Secretary's Road.
Okay, and right here on WPVC 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and you're listening, as I said before, to Your Health. Jamie, speaking of possibilities, and we were talking earlier about how Charlottesville, with the universities and the different gardens and the number of folks that are really intent on food justice, mm-hmm. access to real food in the urban setting, people that maybe have less means.
Right.
Do you think it's possible that we could eventually, as a community, supply 50 or more percent of our food to the residents, to the members of the community?
Yeah, I think it's possible. I mean, we live in such a great area for that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many great producers in this spot of the world. And, you know, organizations like the Local Food Hub are working towards that by hooking up small farmers with the larger institutions in town. Todd Niemeyer, who does awesome work, is doing the urban garden. So, you know, we're on our way, but it really takes a shift of consumer attitude, you know, and it's about kind of educating people about what their choices are, you know, and I think Michael Pollan has that line about you have three chances a day to really impact your local food community, and with breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and you don't have to, you know, make the right choice all the time, especially to start. But if you think about that, maybe one meal a day, and think about trying to make that local, that makes a huge difference.
And it does.
And moves us towards that goal.
That is correct. You are right. We're going to take a little break here, and we will be back. We're talking with Jamie Barrett of Bel Air Farm. And Jamie, there are many ways that people can get access to food. Going to City Market or volunteering, coming out to the farm and whatnot. But there's also another way, the Community Supported Agriculture, or CSA. So how does that program work with you guys?
Yeah, so CSAs are a lot of fun, a great way for a family or individual to get more deeply connected with the farms producing their food.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great because there's so many different models, and every CSA is a little different. So every consumer can kind of do a little research and figure out what their priorities are and find the right CSA fit for them. The way our CSA works is folks come out once a week to one of our spots in town or to the farm. And we give them a bag, a regular grocery store bag, and they fill it up from the 10 to 20 things that we've grown for them. So they kind of get a lot of choice. They can not take things they don't like. They can fill it up with one thing if they're going to do canning or something like that. And then they can also come out and do some pick-your-own flowers, herbs, cherry tomatoes, hot peppers. And we have kids programs on Saturdays, picnic tables set up. We really want people to kind of be able to explore the farm and see how things are going and really understand, you know, how weather is affecting the season and what impact that's having at their dinner table, you know, what they're eating, what they're seeing, and really get to know where it's coming from.
Wow. So that sounds like a really good program. So let's say somebody, are there like what is it, half shares, full
half
shares?
Half shares or full shares. That's
okay.
Right.
And what do those usually run?
So the half share is $365. You can get it for $340 if you pay in full instead of the $100 deposit. And the full share is $650, and you can get a $25 discount on that one as well to bring in $625.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it ends up being, for the full share, it's like $29 a week. You get a big bag of certified organic vegetables.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And are the can they get a meat share as well?
They can. Yep, we do our carnivore share, and that is we break that up into 6 month sessions. And the first one's starting in May, so we got plenty of those. And we raise hogs on the farm, chickens. We have the grass fed beef, and we raise rabbits as well. So that's all available.
Yeah. So you have a wide variety.
Yeah.
Know?
Yep.
And so you could do the pork or the beef for just a carnivore share, and then it would come.
Yeah. Basically, we let people have a lot of choice. So if they come to the farm, they can fill their bag however they like for the carnivore share. But we can also deliver it, and it would be prepackaged, and it would just be a mixture of the proteins.
Of whatever's in season.
Yeah.
Right. And then what about through the winter season?
The winter season, we kind of... it's our time to kind of retool, look at all the parts of our business and see what needs a little help and how we can be more efficient. So we're doing a lot of office work, field schedules, greenhouse schedules, fixing all the equipment that broke. And we don't do winter production vegetable-wise, but we still have the livestock going on in the winter.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's... wow. So what... I noticed a couple of the farms, like they during the winter time, they stopped their say chickens or their beef because they didn't have animals going to slaughter, and they kind of slowed down.
Yeah,
is that do you see that normal or?
Well, so it gets a little more difficult sometimes for the livestock because you got to deal with the water systems get a little more complicated with the cold weather. So some farms probably wean back a little bit. We've got systems in place that we can keep going all winter long.
Oh, wow. Oh, man. That's really neat. So what, I know you certainly have a passion for this.
Yeah, I love it.
And you're still pretty young, so.
Well, getting older.
Your oldest daughter's 10.
That's right.
Kind of early to find out, does she have any designs on carrying forth the family business?
Yeah, you know, whenever they get asked that question, what are you going to be when you grow up? They do always, farming is always in there.
Really?
Among a bunch of other things.
Well, sure.
Yeah, astronaut and everything else. But I don't know, it's hard to know how long they're going to, if that's going to stick. I hope, I could see all of them doing it.
Yeah.
They have the makeup for sure, but who knows what the future will bring for them.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting with kids. I know. Say, what do you want to be when I grow up? I don't know. I recently had the privilege of hearing Alice Waters
from
Edible Schoolyards and all that speak over at the Barrett Hall on Thursday, and she received the Jefferson Medal, which
that's
is
wonderful.
Just,
yeah,
it really is. And one. It was slow food values in a fast food culture.
That's a great
was her
title talking. For the talk.
And she actually came last year and helped setting up the City Schoolyard Gardens over there, that wonderful program that Jeanette Abbey Nader and crew, if you will, Aileen Carey and those, they're doing a wonderful job. So Alice came by and helped them set that up. And I found that interesting because she didn't insist that it be under the, if you want me, you're going to have to join the Edible Schoolyard network.
I see, yeah.
And in fact, they are in that network, but it's our own City Schoolyard Gardens program, which I thought was pretty cool. She was talking about the choices that we have. Either slow food or slow death with fast food, you know. Fast food is slow death. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, you know, because we keep ourselves sick by doing that. Like we said earlier, folks have the access to lots of calories but unfortunately not enough nutrition to keep them healthy. And she was talking all about that. She said that 20% of our meals are eaten in the car.
Oh, my goodness.
I know, right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, you guys, that isn't your case, I know.
Well, I can't, I won't say I never eat in the car. But
yeah, of course, everybody does. Yeah. And even sometimes I'll do it if, you know, if we're going on a trip or something, I make a big bag of food, you know, and it's our food, so we're eating in the car.
Right, right.
But we didn't stop at McDonald's or whatever. Sorry, I should say fast food joint. But yeah, and less than 15% of people eat as a family. It's just scattered,
right?
You know,
right.
And you guys have family dinners.
Oh yeah,
probably more than once a week.
Well, yeah, but all that is so connected to that. I mean, it's grounded in the land, right? I mean, when you find that connection to your local farm or to your home garden, that all follows, I feel like, you know, sitting down and eating and kind of planning the meal out a little more and getting your family involved. I mean, because you're just more connected to where the food's coming from and it's feeling more a part of your life, mm-hmm. and you make it more a part of your life than if you just not open to that. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah.
It absolutely does. One fellow I was talking to mentioned it was like agriculture.
Right.
And it wasn't necessarily what you ate, but how you ate with the family, with knowing where it came from.
Right.
How it was grown.
Well, that goes back to also what you were saying about 50% of, if we could get to a place where 50% of the food was from a locally sourced, that's going to take that culture part of it, a cultural shift for the consumer too, for people in the Charlottesville community who are tremendously supportive, to realize, you know, more about where their food's coming from and really take an interest in that.
That's true. Diversity. And that's what you have there at Bel Air Farm, 1,000 acres. Some of the farm remains fallow for that mm-hmm. particular year,
yep.
so it can rejuvenate,
yep.
get the animals grazing on it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a diverse operation.
Right.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah. So, and that's, you know, that's kind of, if we're going to be sustainable farmers, you really need the diversity. I mean, the kind of, if you looked at that 1,000 acres without a farm, it's very diverse. And so you want to keep that there, you know, and, you know, not impose something different on the farm, but really harness that energy and make it work.
Yeah. So then also collaboration. So that fits your model as well, because you have the grass-fed beef and the partner farms.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do collaborate. And there's some spillover there, right? I mean, you might need a little help. And
we help each other out and communicate all the time. And
that's huge.
It's really exciting because, like earlier, you know, the farm, there's so much possibility there, and the limit is our kind of energy, and so we need more energy, and the more people we bring on the farm, the more partners we can find on the farm, the more possibilities become real, you know, and so that's what's driving us.
And it's an interconnection, right?
Oh, yeah.
You're very interconnected. So, well, then let me ask you this. So this kind of living and participating in growing and you know, selling to consumers and seeing happy customers and people coming back and all that, do you feel, say, like more generous?
Well, I think we can be in a position to be more generous just because we're receiving a lot of generosity when the folks are coming and helping us, or, you know, presenting ideas about, you know, what they would like to see on the farm, or, you know, giving a hand in the greenhouse. It's just a lot easier to be more generous ourselves.
Yeah,
too.
It just naturally flows, doesn't it?
It's
the circle, you know.
Exactly.
You know, you're a conduit for generosity, and you take some of that, use some of it, and then just pass it on.
Right.
And that's basically it.
I mean, and it's the same thing. Like, the farm is so generous to us. You know, we are stewards, but we only reap what we sow, you know? Right. So we've got to be, we've got to be sustainable. And when we are, the farm is so generous to us, and then we can be generous to other folks.
That is great. My wife and I recently started, before a meal, just thinking about the folks that grew the food that we're about to eat.
Oh, wow,
you know?
Yeah.
And then, that's nice, you know, it just sort of connects us before we eat. So, you know, with that goes back to how you eat, and I found it just more grounding and almost like a meditation. It's really neat. And so, but things are still, even with everything you have going on, don't you find a certain simplicity about?
Well, it's definitely, I feel like there's a certain simplicity to the underlying kind of track that we're going on.
Mm-hmm.
And it, the farm kind of tells us what we have to do every day and what we have to do next month. And so that there is simplicity there, but it can also get pretty
complicated as well.
Totally.
Sure.
Yeah.
To try to juggle all that stuff.
Right.
And somebody said, I heard this the other day about how if you plant a field with, you know, one flower type, and they all bloom, it that's beauty. That's beauty.
Right.
But if you plant it with a diversity of many different species of plants and flowers, that's like awesome. That's,
yeah,
that's magnificent. You know, that's like a symphony.
That's right? That. Yeah, I agree with that.
And
yeah.
And so that's where the beauty lies in diversity.
Right.
Regardless of. Yeah. So that's so you have that down there.
We're trying hard to make it work. Yeah.
Look out and see all the things going on and say, wow.
Yeah. I mean, you know, on any given day of the farm, there's things that go wrong, there's things that go right. And,
sure.
And that's the exciting part of it. And the community is really what gets us through those mm-hmm. tough times. Mm-hmm. And because we want to give a great product to our members, because they put a lot of trust in us. And so
wow.
That's what gets us through any bumps in the road.
So I remember I went out to Broadhead Farm.
Yeah.
In Sismo.
They're great.
Yeah, they are. I love them. And so when I first got there, you know, I looked out over the farm as before, you know, I got up with Wally and Susan, and I looked out over the farm, and this peacefulness came over me.
Yeah.
And I just sort of, you know, it's like the deep breath.
Yeah.
And, but then I can imagine a farmer looking at
yeah.
the farm.
Right.
And sometimes get that same peace, but other times go, okay, I need to do this.
Oh, yeah. Well, the farm is never, it's always dynamic, right? It's never right. static. It's hard for me yeah. ever to look at the farm and just see it as like a picture, you know? It's always like, oh, this needs to be done. And so that's how we look at the crew, and I look at the farm.
It's understand.
Just, yeah.
Well, see, the same thing viewed by two or three different folks, and you get two or three different
right. yeah, yeah.
reactions.
Totally.
Reactions to it.
And that's the beauty of it.
Well, it is. Yeah. You're right. So I know that education is important.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that possibly your children do better in school than a lot of kids? Because
well, that would be awesome.
I don't know.
Well, I think a farm is a place where you are constantly dealing with all the elements of the world. You know, so you're mm-hmm. thinking about physics, mm-hmm. math. And so as far as a workshop goes, they're exposed to that. But and I hope kids from all across Charlottesville can come out and experience that. we, as far as education goes, you know, we have folks who sign up for our crew and live in a house on the farm and experience a season. And so what we're trying to do, besides churn out amazing food, is grow new farmers as well. So, you know, some of our apprentices and interns have gone on to start their own operations, and we're real proud of that.
Wow. Yeah, that I can understand that totally. My goodness gracious, this is I love it. I just like the whole idea of, you know, going to a farm or at least eating from a farm and then meeting, you know, guys like yourself and other farmers in the area. It so is there, I know you have a passion for this.
Yes, sir.
You really feel that. What I don't know how to ask it. At the end of the day,
yeah,
and we'll call this a good day, you know.
Okay,
equipment didn't break,
right?
You know, things
rare.
Things went according to plan, yeah. Or maybe something did break and you fixed it.
Yeah, well, that's even better.
Okay,
Because the problem solving that happens with the group of people that are working on the farm,
right.
Is exciting and fun, and so when. The bad day is when you spend a lot of time problem solving and it doesn't work. But the great day is when you problem solve and it fixes the problem. It's really satisfying and the concreteness of the work. You know, we are, you know, working in the soil and we're picking this pepper and handing it to someone to eat. You know, that's a beautiful thing in my mind. That's what gets me going every morning.
Yeah, I'll bet. You're listening to Your Health here on WPVC 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And now we're streaming live at 947WPVC.org. And we're going to take another break here, and we will be back. Hello, hello, hello. We're back. We're talking with Jamie Barrett of Bel Air Farm, just south of Charlottesville on 29, about halfway down, on Route 20.
There you go, yeah.
About halfway between here and Scottsville.
That's right.
And, yep. You know, I actually went to Dilwyn once. Yeah, which is far. You know, they used to mine gold down there. This has nothing to do with your health, but it's just funny. And I saw a dollar store down there, and it said, "We take layaway."
Oh, wow.
And I thought about, wait a minute, layaway at a dollar store? That is a depressed area.
Right.
It really is. They need more good farms down there, diversified farms, you know, and it's amazing. I want to play something for you guys, and it's an interview that I did with Carter Wallace out at Farfield Farm, and he's got a really good take on agriculture. So here we go. Now, Carter, I mentioned earlier about food as medicine, and you actually said that you like to think of it more as agriculture as medicine. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I think probably like most people, I had a more specific calling to sort of redirect my attention and, you know, physical labor and such toward being more involved in agriculture as a producer. And then when you follow one specific calling, it opens up to a number of different callings. So for some people, it's maybe it's in a digestive disorder, you know, that says, hey, I got to figure something else out. This is not working in my diet. For some people, it's just a disconnection from nature, and they follow that. For some people, it's just an aversion to pesticides on their apples. You know, I think what I've found is particularly as we think about food as medicine, or as I observe the what might be posted about widely, you know, food as medicine. It's a very true statement, and there's a lot in there, and it's really a gateway statement. It's a gateway to consider far more about what food is, and it's a gateway to consider not just what we eat, but how we eat it. And when one starts considering that, the desire to have a good apple, an apple that tastes good perhaps, or an apple that doesn't have pesticides on it, or an apple that built soil in the production of the apple as opposed to lost it. You start to really unravel a whole host of questions. And that is an invitation to a culture of that as medicine, more than just the food as medicine. When we desire a really healthy food product, generally, and I can't say I could think of a counterexample to this, we're going to find that that's going to lead us all the way back to an entirely different lifestyle. And really, you know, when you think of some, there's plenty of examples of really impressive yogis and such that might eat an incredibly simple blend that would shock your nutritionist, and you're like, how could you be alive on this? You know, as we mature and down that path of food as medicine, I think everybody comes to understand that it's not just what you eat, but how you eat it. We're not just what we eat, we're how we eat. And we're not just how and what we eat, we're how and what we consume. And so our the dollars that we spend obviously are an amazing immediate implication on the landscape around us.
True.
To pay for a thing is to encourage that thing to continue to exist in the world. So does that thing build soil, or does it send soil down the river to the Chesapeake? What agriculture is, agriculture, the production of food, fiber, things useful to human people from our land and seas, really generally understood. That, at the core of it, in the way in which we engage agriculture most basically, most commonly, every day, is eating. Eating is an agricultural act, to quote the great sage. And eating also the most intimate engagement with nature on a day-in, day-out basis. Nature becomes us, and we literally project ourselves onto nature. Nature literally takes the image of what we are encouraging of it. So what we find with this, with the idea of food as medicine, is it is a gateway drug. It's a gateway path. It's a lure. It's a fish hook for us to be grabbed and ask, what is really making me sick? What is it? Is it really just apples? Because guess what? There's a lot of impressive people who have some seriously open chakras, who don't eat nearly enough to that I would even say should keep them alive, and they're doing just fine, right? So there's something else that sustains us. There's something else that sustains culture. There's something else that brings us happiness than, say, needing a certain organic food or needing this and that. And oftentimes, the food as medicine can become an anxiety, you know? So you know, that's not to say anything of this is wrong. It's all just complex, and it's rich, and it's an invitation to go deeper. And that's why I think it benefits us. And, you know, if you're not there, sorry to spoil the ending. But if you are, then you can bask in this. It's really agriculture as medicine more than it is food. But you got to start somewhere. And for some people, that's food. For me, that was a huge part of it. Wherever you are on the journey, I hope you keep walking.
Well, that gives us an awful lot to think about, Carter. And folks, I encourage you to look more into eating the right things, yes, but also, you know, as Carter said, becoming part of everything around, you know, through yoga, through meditation, whatever your pathway is great. And I just wanted to thank Carter for everything you've given us this morning. Have you got anything else for us, Carter?
Well, you know, these are powerful times we're in. And if there's anything that I feel like I'm meditating on in this season, it's solidarity with the First Peoples of this nation who are putting their bodies and putting their everything on the line to protect water. And water really is quite the meditation. When we think about what water is as a purifier, as a solvent, as a barometer of the health of human culture, are our lives making water more clean or more impure? What is the downstream impact of our life? How is water life? You know, the great naturalist Aldo Leopold said, the water cycle and the life cycle are one, right? And then in the Lakota tradition, the anthem is Mani Wakoni, water is life, right? So how can we look into our religions to pull out that an understanding of that sacrality to enhance the way we experience and use and abuse water? How can we restore a sacred relationship?
Wow. That's pretty deep.
Yeah.
A lot to think about there.
There is a lot there. Yeah.
Yeah. So what,
I mean, it was just very well said. What I hear is, there are all these places that you can start your journey, into a deeper connection mm-hmm. with the food you eat and where it's coming from and how that affects your life and how it syncs with your life. And the important thing is to start that journey and to find whatever place is most convenient for you to kind of hook into it.
Yeah.
And that's the great thing about Charlottesville. It's just, you know, you can be reminded of that again and again and again. And sometimes it takes that reminder.
I think you're right.
Many, many times.
Yeah, it absolutely. And I know that when my wife and I started on eating the right foods, locally grown, that things just seemed better. You know, obviously our health. I mean, I used to get, you know, a couple, three cold, flu, whatever,
right.
Just down days. Mm-hmm. And because I was basically healthy, I could take a couple of three aspirin and rest for a day. And then I was okay. I'm very lucky in that respect. But once we started on this pathway, I haven't had anything in 10 years. I mean, wow, you know.
Yeah,
I know other folks who, you know, they don't particularly eat any particular way, and they say the same thing. I'm thinking they might have forgotten this day or that day down the road. But you know, so, but that's, what do they call that, anecdotal, because mm-hmm. it's just me.
Sure.
Although I've talked to people like you and other farmers in the area that eat the same way, and they have similar experiences.
That's right.
And sans an accident, like a tree limb falling on you or getting hit by a tractor or mm-hmm, whatever, mm-hmm. They don't go to the doctor. They don't need to go to the doctor.
Right.
And so I know Alice Waters said you can pay your slow food provider now or your doctor later.
That's a good way to look at it. Yeah.
It is, you know, and it's just, it's absolutely amazing. What's going on?
And that's another thing about buying local food and thinking. Sometimes I hear folks talk about price or certified organic food, and what I would want to encourage people to do is think about it in terms of that the long term costs and the short term costs.
Exactly.
So you're paying the price of sustainably grown food that is spreading out all sorts of effects into your community, like clean water or less leaching of nitrogen and all sorts of effects, keeping money in your community and getting having land available for your children to go play in parks. And you're not seeing those costs that you're when you buy a 20-cent, you know, whatever. All those long-term costs are hidden, but you're going to pay them, and they're going to be more expensive than what you.
And when you get older, it's harder to withstand or experience a lot of those things.
Right.
Whereas when you're young, you know, you go in and take a couple of pills and you're fine. Of course, that's our Western diet. And I mean, you know, we can go on and on and on about that. Rates of autism are increasing geometrically. It's
yeah.
I mean, I read earlier at the beginning of the century, not this century, but the 20th century, rates of autism was 1 in 5,000. Today it's 1 in 68. If it continues in by 2034, I think, or maybe 2050, can't remember the exact date, it would be every other. Are you kidding me? Where are we going with this, you know? So it's actually my 2 minute drill talks about the diabetes and obesity. And I believe that if we get to that point of 50% or maybe more, I think we're going to see a big drop in childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes. I really believe that.
I believe it too.
In other places, it's happened. And speaking of the 2-minute drill, it's time for that. So I'll go right into it. My 2-minute drill today is about diabetes and overweight. And so many people think that they're destined to be overweight because of genetics. You know, my dad and mom and grandparents are obese and have type 2 diabetes. So will I. It's just automatic. Well, it couldn't be further from the truth. Now I can prove it to you. The Pima Indians are a perfect example. They have two tribes that live on the earth. Both of them are genetically identical. The first group lives in the Sierra Madre Mountains in Mexico. The second group lives in Arizona on the Gila River. They were separated 700 to 1,000 years ago, which, of course, is hardly enough time for DNA change through evolution. The Pimas of Arizona are among the fattest groups of people in the world. The only populations more obese are people living on some isolated Pacific islands. On the Gila River Reservation in Arizona, children as young as 6 and 7 are so obese, they can't run. They lumber across baseball fields out of breath before they get to first base. I mean, you have kids, isn't it? Doesn't it do your heart good to see them running around?
Oh, yeah.
I know, right?
That's their natural course of things.
That's what they do. And so, you know, these people, the ones that are over 35 in Arizona, the rate of type 2 diabetes is 8 times the national average. In fact, the prevalence of diabetes on the reservation is the highest recorded anywhere in the world. By age 50, nearly 60% have type 2 diabetes. And what are they eating? Like many Americans, their diet is largely fats, sugars, and refined flours. Cokes, cheeseburgers, pepperoni pizza, Twinkies, Oreos. Their exercise? Not much. They do farm, but most of the enterprise is run by machinery. And most of them are employed in offices at the tribal government or at the reservation's casino. By contrast, the Pima Indians of rural Mexico tend to be thin, wiry, and strong. They work the land like the generations before them, with their hands and simple tools. Their diet consists almost entirely of the foods they grow. Beans, potatoes, corn, tortillas. I saw tortillas. I said, where do they grow? it's a bush, right? Tortilla bush?
That's right.
They have seasonal vegetables like zucchini, squash, tomatoes, garlic, and green peppers, and fruit, especially peaches and apples. Once a month, they might get a free-range chicken. So they're a plant-based diet, right? Mm-hmm. With a little meat thrown in. On average, the Pima Indians of rural Mexico weigh 65 pounds less than the Pimas of Arizona, and their DNA is identical. In marked contrast to the Arizona Pimas, less than 4% of the ones in rural Mexico develop type 2 diabetes, and in Mexico, it's found primarily over people of 50 years, you know, older than 50 years. Increasingly, the Pimas of Arizona are developing diabetes in their teens, 20s, and 30s. Now, this was all from Dr. Jay Kinney, who is a Ph.D., and a researcher. The westernized diet of processed foods, sodas, and, yes, even organic junk foods like potato chips and brownies are keeping us sick. And Big Pharma doesn't help. They market pills for everything when a healthy diet could reverse those diseases and, in many cases, more effectively. This is the reason why we here at To Your Health emphasize the importance of buying and preparing fresh local foodstuffs. We ask you to join us in supporting the programs of the Food Justice Network and the local farms. We can do it. We can control the majority of our own local food system, resulting in a community with lower health care costs, students who have higher performance results, and adults who are more tolerant of other cultures because they're working together with people of all income stratas and skin colors. Get more tolerance. Oh, my God. Reduce hate. These are the results of a community who works together supporting the local garden project and nearby farms. And I'd like to thank Jamie Barrett from Bel Air Farm,
Oh, thank you so much.
You're so welcome, Jamie. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
All mine. All my pleasure.
And next week we're going to have an interview by that I conducted with Tanya Dekla Cobb, the director of the Negotiation for Environmental and her dedication to the local food movement. And we'll have some exciting guests next week as well. So thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time.
You've been listening to To Your Health with your host, MC Blair. To Your Health is brought to you by Hamilton's at First and Main, celebrating 20 years of sustainable fine dining on the downtown mall. Be listening again next Saturday at 11 for To Your Health. The show is produced by Ben Chambers, production assistance from Mike Friend.